So this is the second lecture, and yesterday, actually, I didn't quite finish what I intended to do. So first of all, I'll quickly finish the leftover from the first lecture. Because the other perspective came from Zhou Kong's multiple ideushi, so I want to tell you a little bit about this before I go on to the applications. So the setting is that you have a Banach domain with smooth weakly pseudo-convex boundary defined by the function r less than 0 is smooth boundary, and it's weakly pseudo-convex. And so the question that was posed is to try to investigate the regularity. If you solve the d-bar, here is for 0-1 form, but it doesn't matter whether it's 0-1 or 0-2 or 0-q and so forth. But to make things simple, it's 0-1. And the right-hand side is smooth up to the boundary. And then on the left-hand side, of course, it's unique up to adding holomorphic functions. So if u is perpendicular holomorphic functions, it's unique. And then you ask whether u is smooth up to the boundary. To do it, in the first place, it could already be solved. The question is of regularity. So you want to do it for a slightly stronger norm because you have error terms from the commutation. So you differentiate the equation on both sides here by a differential operator and commute, and then you estimate the derivative. So the commutator is on the right-hand side. And then in order to absorb the commutator, the estimates have to be a little bit better. So you want an epsilon norm. And also another thing is that the test function has to be in the domain of d bar star, which means the normal component is 0. So when you differentiate, you allow only the differential along the tangent direction so as not to disturb the boundary condition. Okay. And it doesn't really matter whether you lose one direction or not, because the d bar, that is your f, and if the d bar in normal direction is known to be smooth, so that's non-characteristic, and you could recover it from there. So this is the estimate, so-called sub-elliptic estimate. And in general, you don't have it, so you stick in a multiple ideushi at this point, in order to look at the failure. So the epsilon, which is positive, it may depend on the multiplier and the constant 2, and the multiplier form an ideal. And then there's another thing that makes the system different, is that the test functions actually are 0-1 forms. So there are n components, actually n minus 1 components, because one component is 0, the normal one is 0, because it belongs to the domain of d bar star. And when you want to measure the failure, you could also measure the failure for each component separately. Okay. And so you could introduce a vector multiplier. And the vector multiplier introduces 1, 0 instead of 0, 1, because in the inner product, I didn't put the complex conjugate. It's just a technical thing. Okay. So the set of all vector multipliers form a module. So it's a vector prior module. And the important thing is to get information from the multipliers. And to start with, you have the initial membership of the multipliers is the function defining a boundary, because in the interior estimate, we actually have elliptic estimate. So the trouble is with the boundary term. So if you multiply by r, the boundary term disappears, so we just like interior estimate. Another thing is that dd bar r, that's the Levy form, and if Levy form is strongly pseudo-convex, then you also have estimates. So that comes from the boundary term that you gain when it's strongly pseudo-convex. So if you stick this in as a vector multiplier, then everything is fine. Actually, if you fix the j from 1 to n minus 1, if the normal direction is n, then you have a 1, 0 vector, and this one zero form is actually a vector multiplier. And so these are rather simple things from the fact that the interior estimates hold, and the strongly pseudo-convex case, the boundary estimates also hold. The important thing is this piece here, that when F is in the scalar multipliers, the DF is in the vector multipliers. The reason is the following. When you take the estimates, the 0, 1 direction estimate is known to be good, okay, because of the Bodner formula. The covariance 0, 1 derivative is already there, so it's always good. So when you differentiate in a good direction, you always get estimates. Here's the philosophy. Okay. And then you say, why don't you differentiate in a 0, 1? Because we sort of change our convention. We didn't, when the inner product, we didn't take the complex conjugate. So it actually becomes 1, 0. So this is 1, 0. And so this is actually the main thing. This thing tells you that when you differentiate in a good direction, the multiplier becomes another multiplier. And then the second one is the Cramer's rule. So if you have the vector multipliers, and this is the component that's irrelevant, because the test functions belong to the domain of d bar star, so the normal component is 0. So when you take Cramer's rule, you only take Cramer's rule for the n minus 1 components. So you stick this in. Okay. So you get this in the scalar multiplier. And this one actually tells you that the epsilon involved could be changed. So if you take the m power is dominated by something, it means that this f already is there. You pay a price of replacing the epsilon by epsilon divided by m. Okay. Is the order. So that is known as Joe's algorithm. The main philosophy is here. So the main point of this algorithm is that you allow certain differential operators to lower the vanishing order, but you allow only one zero differentiation. As I said, that that is allowed because those are the good directions. Okay, actually it's 0, 1, but the convention makes it 1, 0. And then you can take determinants. And then you can take root taking. So this makes the whole thing an algebraic question. And so let me link this to another thing, involving integrability or non-integrability. Because the failure is defined by the modified ideal shift. Every direction is some failure. And then you are allowed to differentiate in a good direction. And then the question is whether you can generate all directions. And that is the same as the Frobenius theorem of integrability. So we want to link it here. So because when you differentiate, you don't get anything new, it means that the Frobenius integrability is satisfied. And the all the failing directions could be pieced together. And so if indeed that's the case, then the domain is called Levy flat. And you want to get the contrary, the opposite, in order to say that you can generate all directions. That means you don't have integrability. Integrability means Levy flat. And Levy flat, because the 1, 0 or 0, 1 doesn't depend on the convention. That is good. And the question is whether you can generate everything from the 1, 0, 0, 1. And you generate by taking the Lie bracket and so forth. So the question is Levy flat. So when it's Levy flat, of course, the boundary is foliated locally by a complex manifold. And here you want the opposite. You don't even allow partial foliation, not even foliation by multiple points. And that is the whole idea of writing down the condition. So the condition is, this was introduced by D'Angelo, but he didn't do it from the geometric point of view that I explained. So here you take a local holomorphic curve from the unit open one disk in the CN, not in the domain, and ask about the touching order to the boundary. So you pull back defining function F for a touching order, but phi already may have vanishing order. To be fair, you divide by the original vanishing order. So the vanishing order is the minimum order of all the components. And so this is sort of the integrability for multiple points. And you want this order to be bounded. And in that case, Kohn conjecture that you should have sub-elliptic. And so Kong's conjecture was solved for the realistic case about the same time when Kong first introduced his multi-ideal shift. And for the special domain, of course, it's a special case of the realistic situation, but we asked for the effective version. Effective version means what? Effective version means that when you do the algorithm, the epsilon keeps changing, and you want to get an effective bound epsilon, lower bound, depending on the type, which is the order of the multiple point of integrability. Okay. And this one I posted here for an occasion of Joe's 75th birthday and his retirement. And the reason why the effective thing is important is that if you have effective, then you could have a way of getting the realistic case effectively and then getting the smooth case effectively. And here I also outline how to do it. I didn't carry out the details here. So I want to explain a little bit about the Frobenius thing that I told you a moment ago. So the use of Frobenius tells you that if you have an open set and a distribution of k-dimensional subspaces and it's integrable, that means you have k-folds whose tangent spaces are precisely the V. That's integrable if the Lie bracket is inside, or when you define the when you differentiate the defining one forms, you don't get anything new, it's already spanned by them. Okay, so these two things are equivalent. And the Frobenius theorem is the theorem for full integrability. So so we are interested in the opposite. We want to look at integrability over Artinian subschemes or multiple points. So for example, you take an ideal which contains a certain power of the maximal ideal. This will be finite dimensional. That's a Artinian ring. And so this is called Artinian subscheme. And this is sort of complex jet version of the concept of integral perf to a distribution of linear tangent subspaces. And Carl Theodori started the question of partial Frobenius integrability. In this paper, this was motivated by thermodynamics, actually the second law of thermodynamics, and he was interested in integrability along a curve. That means a certain state could be joined to another state. Okay, so this was introduced to look at the question of energy, the most efficient heat engine and so forth. Maybe it's not very relevant. The Kong's algorithm could be looked at as the opposite of Frobenius, and is formulated in a differential in the differential version. There's a Lie bracket version of criteria. There's a differential version of the criteria. Of course, two things are equivalent by Cartan's formula. Okay. So here, Kong's statement is about the differential version. You keep on the forms, you keep on differentiating whether you are getting anything new or not. And the, I forgot this slide. So in Kong's case, the boundary is the hypersurface, and the distribution would be the complex or J-invariant subspaces. And Frobenius full integrability Lebesgue, Artinian subscheme integrability means local holomorphic curve touching the high order, and finite time means a limit on that subscheme. And then you ask for a similar formulation of Frobenius criterion, and Kong's can be interpreted as the criterion for a differential version of Frobenius statement. Okay. So when you differentiate, whether you get anything new, and the opposite means that you differentiate, you always get anything new until the final thing, which is the unit. And of course, you don't need to differentiate anymore. So that's the interpretation of the Kong algorithm. So the reason why I presented it, because this is very important, it incorporates several things. The basic philosophy that with your multipliers, when you differentiate the multiplier in the good direction, you yield multipliers. Okay. And then the question is, the multipliers will tell you the bad directions. And you generate good things if the bad directions are not integrable. Yeah. So this incorporates a lot of things. And the criterion for non-integrability is given in a differential form. Because you could ask, what happens when you take the Lie bracket form? And that has never been done. Because I always thought that it's a matter of sitting down and going through a dictionary. Okay. Now, before that, actually, people are looking at Lie brackets and then the Leibniz form and so forth. But they didn't do the nonlinear case. And that's the reason why, I guess, Tom Bloom and other people will look at that question. And they didn't quite do it. And then there is a lot of work by, I think, Xiaoxun Huang and then Barandi and so forth. Yeah, but they never look at the interior in the nonlinear version either.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
So for the vector bundle case that you did yesterday,
yeah.
What are the Artinian subscripts?
It's not the Artinian subscript in that case. In that case, the multiple ideals would be the subbundle, the destabilizing subbundle. You see, here the situation is quite different. In a thing yesterday, the base is fixed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So there's not a matter of saying that you have a point or not, because the base is fixed. Whatever you have is only vertical. So the question is whether you have a sub-bundle or a sub-sheave and so forth. Instead of saying that you have a Artinian sub-skill, the situation is very different from here. So what I said yesterday was the easiest case, because the linear thing, the base is fixed. And in the case of Nadel, the base also changes. Okay. So now here is the second lecture proper. I want to look at application of algebraic geometry. What kind of things you can do? Okay. So there are a couple of things: the effective results, like the Fujita conjecture and the Matsuzaka Big Theorem, effective Lucent and Zach and so forth. And then the second thing, so these things are linear. The second things are less linear. There's the invariance of progenera and the lower volume form, and then the finite generation of the canonical ring and so forth. Okay. So so there's a finite generation of the canonical ring. So I'm going to do these things and point out to you the main ideas and how multiple ideal sheaves are being used. So for the effective results, actually the use come from Nadel's version, and the version that's being used is the static version. That means in Nadel's version, the multiple ideal sheave comes from a sequence of deformations of the Kähler potential. Okay, actually you want to terminate the sequence. But here we don't need such a strong thing. Until we get to finite generation, in that case you have to terminate an infinite process. But for the effective results, you don't need to terminate the process. And so in Nadel's case, you have a family of deformations of or perturbations of Kähler potentials, and they are the simultaneous bonds would give you the multiple ideal sheave. And now if you look at a fixed one, then it is far simpler. So it's a generalization of Kodaira's vanishing theorem. So in Kodaira's case, when you have X is a compact complex manifold, and L is a positive line bundle with a smooth metric, so that the curvature is strictly positive, that means phi is strongly produced harmonic. Here is the vanishing theorem. And in the case of multipliers, the metric here actually plays the role, or the e to the power minus phi, the phi, plays the role of the perturbation of the Kähler potential. So this thing may become degenerate. And so you assume that phi may be singular, but it still strictly produces a harmonic. So the curvature current is still strictly bounded from below in the sense of currents. It dominates a smooth positive 1-1 form. And then you have the multiple ideal shift in the static situation is defined by the holomorphic function germs. These function germs are holomorphic, so this is integrable. And then you get the vanishing of cohomology. You remember this was developed so that you could get the vanishing of cohomology inherited by the destabilizing subspace. Okay, so that was the intermediate step for that. Now, if you look at this static situation, actually there's already an algebraic version known in 82. Of course, in the algebraic version, metric is less general. It's not a general Poisson harmonic function, but for application, the algebraic geometry actually suffices. However, people didn't do much about effective results because the geometric motivation came from multiple ideal shifts and from geometry. Even though later you could translate back to algebraic geometry and get rid of all the analysis, but before the analysis was used, with the motivation from geometry, people didn't know how to use the algebraic tools. Okay. So in this case, NATOS is more general, but when you apply to algebraic geometry, it doesn't really matter. So let me tell you a little bit about, that's a misprint here. This is Fujita. So I'll tell you a little bit about Fujita conjecture. First, it arose from a polycanonical embedding. So that was the original problem about modular function and so forth. So you take a compact Riemann surface genus at least two, then it's negatively curved. And you take the universal cover is the disk. And the covering transformations would be a discrete subgroup and so forth. And so if your Riemann surface like this, it can be represented in two ways. One is that it can be represented by a curve in a projective space, or it can be represented by the quotient of the disk. And the question is how to go from one to the other. And if you have a discrete subgroup representing it, the question is how do you represent it as a curve? That means how do you embed M into it? So originally this Poincaré series, so you take any function, bound holomorphic function on delta, and then you take the sum after you make it invariant under gamma. The trouble is that if you don't put this DZK there, you know that you cannot make it invariant because the invariant of the holomorphic function on the quotient, it must be constant, it's useless. So you put in this DZK. And what is the use of DZK here? The name DZK is that when you take the transformation, the Jacobian determinant comes into the picture. And so you look at the fundamental domain, and the Jacobian determinant comes into the picture, so the area of the fundamental domain gets changed to the next one. If you sum up, you get the area of the disk, so it's finite. So automatically you have a convergence, the K is at least two, because of the Jacobian determinant coming in, and you're summing the volume. And of course, the greater the K is, the faster the convergence, because the Jacobian determinant gets closer and closer to zero when the fundamental domain gets to the boundary. So the Poincaré series, if you put in a dz to the power k, which helps you get convergence, is a polycanonical section of the quotient. So that's historically why the thing came about. And then you check that if k is bigger, the convergence gets faster, so you could ignore the remaining terms and you only concentrate on the first few. And if it's convergence fast enough, you get the first few and then you get a good choice of bounded holomorphic functions to separate points and give local coordinates. So you could check that for k at least 4, you could separate points and give local coordinates because of the rate of convergence. Okay. So in other words, if you take bases, you can use a homogeneous coordinate defining embedding. So when genus at least 2, you have this way of embedding by four canonical sections. Oh, let me. So the question is, what happens to the n-dimensional case? So people say, well, ask whether you could get a number which is independent of the manifold, but only depending on the dimension. And instead of genus, the analog is canonical line bundle positive. So if you could embed like this, you say that this K canonical line bundle is very ample. Okay. And so when n equal to 2, 5 is very ample and so forth. And then pluricanonical embedding conjecture is that n plus 3 should be very ample. Okay. And so that's not yet solved. Now Fujita want to separate the role of the positive line bundle and canonical line bundle. So we said that if you have positive line bundle, which may not be the canonical line bundle, then you ask whether you could define a map by getting global sections which have no common zeros. So so he conjectured n plus 1 l plus k would be good enough. N plus 2 l plus k would also give local coordinates, so you would get the embedding. That's known as the Fujita conjecture. And why do you have such a conjecture? Because you just check the extreme cases. In the case of the projective space, this kx is minus n plus 1. Fujita checked that in general, if you only look at metrics, this n plus 1 l plus k is numerically effective. That means it's thought any complex curve is non-negative. And then it admits the metric, which has positive curvature, so at least it qualifies, so far as metric is concerned, to be candidates. And Fujita, in his conjecture, in the paper where the conjecture was written, he proved this much. Okay, so these are the consequences of the conjecture, but the evidence that is a reasonable thing. So So since the early 90s, after the multiplied U-series came on and so forth, a lot of people work on it, and it's still not completely solved, so I want to tell you what is known. Okay, so Lassesfeld, I think this was the result of discussion in Oberwolfach, that the freeness has verified dimension 3, and then Kawamata verified dimension 4. And then Anger and my student with me wrote a paper actually verified for any dimension, but then we couldn't get the linear n, because originally it's n plus 1 and so forth. We could only get quadratic. Okay. And so in general, you could say that it separates quite a number of points and so forth for the freeness. And so if you come back to the original pluricanonical embedding, this is just general nonsense here. If B is free, A is ample, then this is very ample. This is just general nonsense. And so as a consequence, when L is the K, then you have N cubed very ample. So the original thing is N instead of N cubed. So at least this much is known. And then Hemke, who is now in Japan, I think, he formulated in terms of churn numbers instead of multiples of line bundle, because the main point is that the churn numbers are high enough, it's good enough. The multiple is just to make sure that the churn number is good enough. If ML raised to the power n, the churn number is at least m to the power n. Okay, so we could formulate it that way, and he introduced a couple of tricks, which is improvement. And then this is probably the last thing that Heyer, also my student, in fact, but not in name, I think he got his degree from Bochum. Okay, made some improvement. He actually get the exponent 4/3 instead of 2, because their conjecture one is n. So for very ampleness, the preceding ones were freeness. So for very ampleness, what are the results? And if you have 2k, then it's easier to handle. The reason is that just like the case of Poincaré series, higher multiples of k would help you do it. When you take the vanishing theorem of Kodaira to do something, you need a k. If you want to apply twice, you need a 2k. That's why it makes things easier. And Dimayi first used Meng Zhongpei equation to do this for ML plus 2k. And then actually I look at it from the point of view of the original multiple ideal shift, the concept of original multiple ideal shift. Actually, you don't need any linear things, because this kind of thing is linear. You could get it this way here very simply. Okay. But if you don't have 2k, then it's more complicated. So in that case, you need what I call higher order multiple ideal shift, because you don't want to apply vanishing theorem until the very last step. So you would get higher order multiple ideal shifts. So you take extension of one multiple ideal shift by another, which is not a higher multiple ideal shift. The reason multiple ideal shifts are being used is to get the vanishing theorem. And before you do it, you could prepare it to make the base point set as small as possible, so to speak, or zero set as small as possible. So I never make public the preprint in general. Is rather involved, but the complication is mainly algebra only. And I wrote it down for the case of n equal to 2, because the algorithm is easier, and that was published. Okay. So another thing I want to point out is the Matsuzaka Big Theorem. The difference between Matsuzaka Big Theorem and the Fujita Theorem is that Fujita has the ML plus K, because when you apply a vanishing theorem, you need a K. You don't need a K, then things are a bit more complicated. So Matsuzaka first get the embedding, which depends on the Hilbert polynomial. So there's a number here, Hilbert polynomial, so this is very ample. This is not a Matsuzaka big theorem, it's a very important theorem. And then Kolar, his student, made the improvement saying that the dependence only on the first two coefficients of Hilbert polynomial, Ln and Ln minus 1k. Okay. But the argument is not effective. The argument is a Noetherian argument, is a bounded family argument. So for any given manifold, by Kodaira's embedding theorem, you get a multiple. And then you look at the set of points where this multiple doesn't work in the moduli space. And then it's a subvariety of, and then it's a bounded family. You just pick one in each branch and repeat the same thing. And then Noetherian argument will show you that it stops. Okay. But then, of course, it's not effective. So that was before the era of the multiple ideal shifts. Here, this probably is the latest get multiple ideal shift to do it, so it's effective, the bounds are huge. Okay. And before that, the first time I did this was in an issue dedicated to Magrange in Grenoble. So I wrote in 93, and Dimayi made improvement in his lecture notes in 94. And the question is the exponential order, still exponential. And then in dimension 2, Fernandez del Busto tried to get a linear gate thing, a better version. And so he wrote down a dimension 2 case. But in general, there's not even a conjecture to a precise description of the number. And then I want to say something about the Newton's arcs. So of course, Newton's arcs is due to Hilbert. You have an ideal. If you take a radical, a certain power of the radical belongs to the ideal. The question is, what is the power of the radical so that it is an ideal? Brownwell is the first one to get an effective thing, and it came from Kodaira, Skoda's theorem on D bar estimates. This thing actually very much related to multiple ideal shift. So if you have no common zeros, then you could get one expressed in terms of the Fs, and then you get some bound on the degree. Okay. So I want to tell you about how what these things, why these things work. So first, there's the SCOTUS result. It is an extremely important paper here. You have a domain, actually, domain spread over CN, and then you have a Fourier harmonic function, and you are given functions G1, GP. You want to investigate whether another given function can be expressed in terms of G1, GP. And of course, if you F can be expressed in G1, GP, the absolute value of F will be dominated by the supremum absolute value of G. You want to get L2 estimates, you want to say that the L2 divided by the L2, the sum of the absolute value square will be finite instead of sigma. But if you don't use sigma, use L2, there's a question of integrability by polar coordinate. Some exponent, depending on the dimension, has to be entered, like N or something. So he said that to be more precise, is this Q, and then you have alpha bigger than 1. If this is finite, then you can so express it, and then the coefficient here also satisfies the same thing. The exponent is 1 less because there's already a G here. Okay. So this is a very important thing because it tells you what power is needed. The power essentially comes from N. So let me explain to you how these things are being used. So for example, if these are homogeneous polynomials of certain degree, gamma, without common zero except at the origin, then of course this thing is comparable to it, because you just take the projective space and you're just dilating from that. And you can look at integrability. So far the origin is concerned, you raise to the right power, then of course it's integrable, and then there's the question of infinity. These things are already comparable. In order to make sure that they are integrable at infinity, you stick this thing in. Okay. This thing is the same as e to the power minus psi. Okay. So by SCOTUS theorem, you could so express it, and they satisfy this as well. So of course, the reason why we use the z is because we are in a homogeneous case. You have an estimate like this. All you need is the Hilbert's inequality. You need an L1 estimate of this, because this is L2. And you do it for a ball, and this thing, of course, you can just evaluate explicitly. And then by some mean value property or Cauchy integral formula for derivative, we show that it's polynomial. Okay. So that's the way that the effective Newtonian arch works. Okay. It comes from L2 estimate. So Collard did this for a general ideal, but he translated this back into algebraic geometry. Okay. So the one I told you is multiplied usually with L2 estimate, translated algebraic geometry. Okay. And then Bonnewell got refinement. This refinement is sort of not that essential. You take an ideal, in that case, is not expressed, the zero set is not empty, so you have primary decomposition in the subvarieties and so forth, and then if you have something in the ideal, first you have something in the ideal of each component, and then you can treat each component separately, so to speak. So this is not really that serious a thing. And then Ian Lassersfeld also changed it to a general manifold instead of PN, again, use primary decomposition and do each one separately. So the main thing is still SCOTUS idea. So you can see that the final result is like this, that you take the root, the N has to be there. The N actually comes from the SCOTUS thing, the L2 estimates. Okay. So I just want to tell you how the effectiveness happens here in these cases. Okay. Now I want to tell you about how things work in the other applications, in the Fujita and so forth. Mainly, these things come from the granddaddy argument of Kodaira, of the embedding. But Kodaira is not effective. And I just want to tell you the difference between the two. Why one is effective, why it's not effective. And that's it. Okay. So Kodaira's idea is interpreting the multiple ideal shift is the following. So you take a smooth metric, but you want to create some singularity, some multi-ideal shape in the modern language. So you take a local coordinate at the point P0, look at this function. This is locally priest harmonic, Q log epsilon z squared, the coordinate center at P0. And then you could, by partitional unity, extend it to a smooth function outside. Of course, there's singularity here at P0. But this thing would not be a Poisson harmonic after it extends, because it's only Poisson harmonic locally. However, the function phi here is strictly Poisson harmonic. So when you raise a sufficiently high power of the metric, that means m times phi, the difference, the sum here is strictly Poisson harmonic locally. Okay. So the new metric, of course, would be given by this one. So e to the power minus this guy would be the new metric. This is a global function. Okay. But the m is not effective, because you simply extend this by partitional unity, depends on the manifold. You don't really know what's going on, so that's the reason why m is not effective. But once you get this multiple ideal shift, it's only a single point. Okay. When k is large, it has some vanishing order and so forth. So then you would get the vanishing of the cohomology. Look at exact sequence surjective here. That means the global sections would generate the end jets. So original proof of codality used multiple ideal shift. He uses a blow up, but it's the same thing.
I'm not sure. So the multiple ideal shift is holomorphic
germ when you multiply every one. Yeah, it's integrable. Yeah. But here, this is the only singularity. So, well, it's a germ, so it's a sheaf, so locally it's integrable. But everywhere else is smooth, so there's always holomorphic things are always integrable. The only thing that would give you trouble would be this guy here. Yeah, because you get e to the power minus that. E to the power minus this. So it's 1 over epsilon z to the power 2q. Yeah, so that's not integrable. So you will have to have a holomorphic function germ that vanishes to certain power before you can make it integrable. So the multiple ideal shift would have zero at a single point. Yeah. And so therefore, if you have a vanishing of the cohomology, then this is surjective. So that actually is the reason why things work. And also it tells you that why it's not effective is because of this guy here. So then you want to change the situation, and the main thing is to construct modified ideal shifts with isolated zeros. So what you do is that you change your trick of defining singularity. Instead of like epsilon z square, you want to do something else. And what you do is you use what I call a multivariate holomorphic section. A multivariate holomorphic section means you take a certain power, it becomes an actual section. The reason is that if you have a multivariate holomorphic section, you can take 1 over summation epsilon square. That would be a metric. Why is it a metric? Because if you take a local section sigma, the epsilon value sigma square multiplied by the metric should be well defined. And that's indeed the case, because they change in the same way. And only epsilon value is being used, so multivariate holomorphic section works. Okay. And so that's the way you produce a metric that has singularities. So the metric satisfies the condition is strongly pseudo-convex and so forth. Okay. And then how do you get singularities? Singularity would come from this LS1 and so forth vanishing together. So the effectiveness comes from modifying Kodaira's argument. So here, let me explain this theorem that I proved with a student Ungern. So if you take Riemann rock, take a high power, then you know what power to take to make things vanish to a certain order. Because the Riemann rock, the dominant term is the first one. Okay, doesn't matter what the rest is. But after you get the vanishing order, you take roots again. So the vanishing order depends effectively on this multiple. And of course, in that case, you could write down the metric from a singularity of this multi-value section that vanishes in order, but you cannot make the singularities or the zero set isolated. because this is just produced by Riemann-Roch. You have no idea what it looks like. Okay. And that is a challenge. And so the zero set may be a subvariety, and then you repeat the Riemann-Roch to the subvariety and extend a multivariate section. Multivariate section can always be extended because you take a certain power, the thing is very ample and so forth, you extend, take a root. Okay, so we can always extend it. So in that case, you mix the original one with the new one. The original one raised to a certain power with a singularity, you raise it to lower power, you will have less. And then you take your new one in, so that you cut down on the zero set. And when you keep on doing like this, the first time you do it to get non-integrability is because of polar coordinates, you have to have vanishing order n to guarantee that that's the case. The second one would be n minus 1, that's why you end up with this. Okay, that's the reason. And then you want to be more economical, then you get better results. And that actually is the reason why the original thing is still open. And there is a scheme for solving original thing. It's what I call the feedback process. Actually, it was something that Fujita at one point proposed. And what is the feedback process? The reason why you want to produce multivariate section is to make sure that it has certain vanishing order. Okay. So you produce n vanishing orders to make sure it's not integrable, but it may give you more vanishing than you bargained for. It gives you some bonus vanishing, so to speak. It's not only a single point, but it vanishes on a high dimensional subvariety, and you are in trouble. And then you argue that if you have some bonus, maybe when you choose the vanishing, you don't want vanishing in all directions to order n, because the bonus would be like codimension 1 vanishing. Then you need only look at the normal direction and say that the normal direction vanishes dimension to order n. But then if you do that, you don't get your bonus. It's just like buying your merchandise, you get a rebate when you pay for it, but before you pay for it, you don't get your rebate. And so if you spend all the money getting the vanishing order in all directions, then you get an extra rebate, which is the vanishing codimension 1. But if you do it only, you pay only the difference between the rebate and the merchandise price, you don't get anything. You just get the normal direction, you don't get anything. So this question of full feedback, and then you say that let's write down an equation to see what happens. But the trouble is that these things are not just adding. These things are highly nonlinear when you hear Riemann-Roch. So this feedback process, nobody could make precise. Okay. So the idea is a compromise. Say if you codimension 1 vanishing extra, then you look at the normal direction, there's the difference between the rebate and the price, but then you don't get it. So you may have to have some extra one in the codimension 1 direction. So you would determine an ideal, so to speak, an ideal. And you would get vanishing on this ideal before you proceed. The ideal is determined by this feedback process. And I tried very hard on it, couldn't perfect it good enough. At one point, Helmke claimed that he could do it, but he never wrote it up. That is a challenge. And it's not undoable, but it is non-trivial. And with lower dimension is easier, so that's why the 4 dimension 3 is easier. Okay. Now, there's another catch I want to point out. You see, when you have a vanishing order and polar coordinates and so forth, to get into non-integrability. So if it's a regular thing, let's say dimension n, then if you have vanishing order n, then you have non-integrability. But if you have singularity, the situation is different. And so the algebraic geometers knew about this, and they got stuck for a long time, until multiplier Dushev came along. And let me explain this situation in the simplest case. So let's say that the ambient space is C2. And after the first step, you end up with a vanishing codimension 2, codimension 1. So it's a curve. So it's called V. So if the curve is regular, then if you want a function on the curve vanishing to order M, you need only M equation because it's regular. But if the zero set of the first step of the multiplier Dushev is not regular, for example, if it's a cusp, then you take the normalization and so forth, and you look at this thing here and look at the equation needed to get the vanishing order. So if you get order m, then these things have to vanish. You pull back to normalization, you look at the number of equations. It's more than the straightforward one. So I, instead of doing the combinatorics, I just say that m equal to 2, you count it as a 3. M equal to 3, you just count it, there will be how many? 6. So it's more than you know. And if you have no control over the singularities, you don't get the effectiveness. Actually, this has been holding up the Greek geometers for a long time. And how do analysts handle this situation? This is handled by so-called semi-continuity of multiple ideal shift. So you want the zero set of multiple ideal shift to be at this point because you want the freeness of the section at this point, that the line bundle will be generated at that point, and you have no choice, even though it's very singular. Okay, but if you go next door to other things that are regular, then you have no trouble because you just count the right one. And then next door you have a multiple ideal shift. And then you look at the how the multiple ideal shift converges from the next one to the one you have. And that's the question of semi-continuity of multiple ideal shift. So if there's a zero set for the multiple ideal shift nearby, the question is, when you get to the limit, whether the limit has one. Then you say, well, are things smooth, analytic, and so forth, there's no trouble because these things are produced by multivariate sections. So you could use as parameter your original manifold and get the Riemann-Roch applied there. So there's no question about it. The only thing is the question of semi-continuity or multi-ideal shift. Just want to point this out. And the analysts did it by using this extension theorem of Osawa Takegoshi. You have a complex manifold, and then you have a Banach holomorphic function with a zero set, and then you have a Poisson harmonic function. And the question is, if you have some holomorphic functions, which is L2 on the set Z, whether it could be extended to a function that L2 nearby. So if you have extension of L2, there would be L2 in most slices. That's Fubini theorem. Okay. So with the regular one, each one is not integrable, then the limit cannot be integrable. So that was the thing. So here is the precise estimates. So if you are integrable on this Z defined by W equal to 0, and whether F can be extended to another one, that's also integrable. So you slice it nearby, then there would be many, many slices integrable. Okay. And so if you have the regular points where the multiple ideal shift has zeros, then the limit one has zero. And this one helps you get the effectiveness. And also, it is for this reason that it makes the feedback process more complicated. Because the feedback process tells you extra vanishing, and at generic points, there would be things are very much under control. And then the feedback also, there's some semi-continuity of the feedback which I could not handle. So now let me tell you something about the effective Matsuzaka theorem when there's no Kx. So the main thing is to subtract Kx from it. And this is a trick. This trick is Kodaira's trick. So if you have two line bundles, oh, there's a misprint. This means F and G. Okay. So F, G, and you want to get a non-identically zero multivariate holomorphic function F minus G, all you need is this. The reason is that you get a divisor for G, and all you get sections on multiples of F vanishing on the divisor of G. And then just accounting how many, what is the dimensional restriction and so forth. So that's this is Kodaira's trick. And so in the case of effective Matsuzaka big theorem, you subtract a K from it, and that's why the Chern numbers enter the picture. You remember the Chern number L to the power N and L to the power N minus 1K? The one to be subtracted is the K. And that's why you get some bound depending on Ln and Ln minus 1 times k. Okay. So that's extra thing for the Matsuzaka big theorem. And as I said, that there's actually no conjecture good bound for it. Okay, so I'm going to skip this because I already said something. Okay. Now the next thing I want to tell you is the invariance of Purigenra. Okay. And the finite generational canonical ring. Okay. So the invariance of Purigenra, the motivation, it comes from the Hodge number. So if you take the genus, which is the dimension of the canonical Lie bundle, and this pre-canonical Lie bundle is the M genus. And of course, in the case of one genus, this is just the Hodge number, it's always invariant. In the case of M genus, it's not clear that if you have a holomorphic family, whether it's invariant or not. Okay, so there's a conjecture, and this one is still unsolved. If you have a holomorphic family of compact Kähler manifolds, and you ask, why do you want to look at compact Kähler manifolds? Because when the case of one genus, it is Hodge number. And of course, the Hodge number is unchanged if you have Kähler structure. Otherwise, you will be in trouble. So that's why you look at it from the point of view of Hodge structure, you should look at the family of Kähler manifolds. And then you ask whether the M genus is independent of the deformation. Of course, in angular 1, this is the Hodge number. And the conjecture is equivalent to extending a section from a fiber to the family, because you have semi-continuity. You can only jump up, and you have some fiber, you can always extend, you cannot jump up. Okay. So in view of the extension theorem of Osawa Takagoshi, maybe you can introduce a twisting. You introduce a twisting and a metric for the twisting, you want to ask the same thing. You see, the Osawa Takagoshi, the case M equal to 1. Okay. So when M is general, then it's sort of the proper setting. So of course, you could formulate for Kähler and so forth, but so far, you don't, can you do it? Okay. So what are the results? No. First of all, Levine did this in the 80s. If you have a section that is smooth divisor, that means this alignment is represented by smooth divisors, then you can do it from Hodge theory. Because the reason is that you could take some sort of branching tool in order to get it back into the Hodge numbers. And the smooth things are easy to handle. So this actually was done by Hodge theory. Okay. And then later wrote a paper saying that if the singularity is mild, you can also do it. And also if it's not Kähler, Fujiki class, also the same kind of thing would work. Okay.
That means that pretty
general,
in terms of the Hodge numbers,
can be written in terms of the Hodge numbers. Yeah, but Hodge number in a different family, essentially. You take some branch cover and then, yeah, okay, yeah. Of course, you can always argue that you resolve the singularity and so forth, but the trouble is the main catch here is that the section, the pluricanonical section, is only on the initial fiber. Singularity is only on the initial fiber. So, of course, extending it is extending the divisor, the same thing. So you can extend the divisor, you always can resolve singularity, another thing, and so forth. So it's a bit tricky here. It's not completely trivial. And he did it actually by deformation of so by taking over multiple points and so forth. That actually is the way he did it. You couldn't get a branch cover because the device is only on initial fiber, but you could do it on multiple points. If things can be extended over certain multiple points, then it could be extended. That's just the implicit function theorem of Artin. Okay, so you could always do this. So that's why this could be done. And this may be the correct approach, but so far, for a long time, people couldn't do it. So when I try to use multiply abusive, I just believe these things are extremely powerful. I use multiply abusive to get the invariance of Purigenra. And I explained to you why these things were useful. And one of the reasons why I look at it is because it related to this finite generator canonical ring. That was the reason why I looked at it. And so first I did it for general type, and then for the case of general type, which involves some more analysis. It's just a matter of getting estimate. Okay. And then Mihai did the twisting case, the case I mentioned to you, twisting by L. Okay. But all the time is only for the algebraic manifold. Why for the algebraic manifold? Because you can extend things when the Lyman bundle involves a very ample or something, the vanishing theorem. Okay. So you want to measure the deviation from something very ample, and that actually is a philosophy that also works for the finite generation of the canonical ring. And of course you can say, well, you twist it, then you can extend it, but the twisting depends on M. The idea is to get a twisting independent of M. And that actually is it goes back to the idea of this dynamic multiply ideal shape. It works for all M. Okay. So I will explain this in more detail a bit later. Okay. Maybe I'm over time. So what remains is some leftover to be done tomorrow, unfortunately, because I used some time for the leftover from yesterday. Okay, so this leftover is going to tell you how it's related to the minimal model conjecture, which is the related to the finite generation of the canonical ring. Okay, so so if you know the finite generation of the canonical ring, how do you get the invariance of progenera and the other way around as well. So I think I'll stop here, and then I'll resume from this point on. Okay, tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you.